From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Donald Trump just wrapped up a news conference that was intended to announce his new nominee for Labor Secretary, but ended up being about much more than that. And it sounded at times more like a campaign speech than a presidential press conference. NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley is with us. Hi, Scott.
Hi, Jeremy.
And first of all, your thoughts on how Trump came across in this press conference, which was, you know, some people would say bizarre for a presidential press conference.
He came across as defensive, wounded, irritated, and eager to change the subject from what has been a lot of sort of negative headlines. He wants to go back to talking about his glory days on the campaign trail. He again talked about the scale of his Electoral College victory, overstating the size of that Electoral College victory. He talked about encouraging poll numbers, about the large crowd that he expects at a campaign-style rally in Florida this weekend. This is a man who really enjoyed being at campaign rallies throughout the campaign and is not enjoying governing quite so much.
And he took questions from a lot of different reporters, not just friendly publications as he has been doing in other press conferences, but all kinds of reporters.
Absolutely. And he got some tough questions and he gave us a few answers. He did talk a little bit about substance. He said that they're going to come out next week with a replacement for the travel ban that has been suspended by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. He talked a little bit about his plans for repealing and replacing Obamacare and then down the line doing a tax reform plan. But mostly this was an opportunity for the president to air his grievances at stories of disorder and dysfunction in the White House and to argue not terribly persuasively that his White House is actually a finely tuned machine.
Hmm. You mentioned the new executive order that he says is coming next week. Let's listen to him talk about that.
As far as the new order is going to be very much tailored to the what I consider to be a very bad decision. But we can tailor the order to that decision and get just about everything, in some ways more.
Do we have any sense at this point of what this new order might be?
No, except that the goal will continue to be to somehow restrict entry into the country of people that the president and his aides consider to be a potential threat. But he says, that, as you heard him there, saying that they're going to tailor it to the findings of the Federal Appeals Court, which ruled that the original order, it didn't reach a final decision, but which suspended the order after agreeing with the lower court's judge that it might be found to violate due process. And other constitutional had other constitutional flaws with it. The president also took aim at the Ninth Circuit, saying that the court was in turmoil and pointing out that it is reversed frequently by the U.S. Supreme Court. In fact, the Ninth Circuit is reversed a little bit more often than some other federal appeals courts, but is not the most reversed court in the land.
Scott, Trump was asked about the resignation of his national security advisor, Mike Flynn, earlier this week. Here's what he said about that.
When I looked at the information, I said, I don't think he did anything wrong. If anything, he did something right. He was coming into office. He looked at the information. He said, that's fine. That's what they're supposed to do. They're supposed to be. And he didn't just call Russia. He called and spoke to both ways. I think there were 30 some odd countries. He's doing the job. You know, he was just doing his job.
He was just doing his job, Scott, but isn't it illegal to do that job when you don't actually have that job?
Well, this is the message that's been coming consistently from the Trump White House. The question was whether Michael Flynn had discussed in his conversation with the Russian ambassador U.S. sanctions against Russia, which the outgoing Obama administration had just imposed in retaliation for Russian meddling in the U.S. election. And the Trump organization has said administration has said all along there was nothing wrong in Michael Flynn discussing those sanctions. The problem was he didn't tell the vice president. He told a different story. He misrepresented the conversation in his account to the vice president and to other aides. Now, the one question has been, when he had that conversation with the ambassador, was Mike Flynn freelancing or was he in fact acting at the direction of the president? The president said today he had not directed his national security advisor to have that conversation, but he said if he hadn't been having it, I would have told him to have it.
Hmm. And just in the few seconds we have left, the news that was supposed to come out of this is who the new labor secretary pick is going to be, and that's Alexander Acosta. Just briefly tell us about him.
Well, he's not related to Jim Acosta, the CNN correspondent and frequent foil for the president. He's someone with Labor Relations Board experience. He's been through a Senate confirmation process before. But he wasn't at this news conference today, which I think suggests it was something of a pretext to use that announcement. The real purpose of this news conference was to give the president a chance to air his irritation with the news media and to express his defensive message.
That's NPR White House correspondent Scott Horsley. Scott, thanks as always.
You bet.
Well, over in Congress this morning, House Republicans strategized on how to repeal the Affordable Care Act, which is expected to be a flashpoint in lawmaker town halls next week. House Speaker Paul Ryan said that Republicans will soon introduce a bill to repeal and replace Obamacare, which, in his words, is collapsing.
On Tuesday, another major insurance company announced that it too, will leave the marketplace. In its decision, Humana cited a lack of young people signing up, a problem that has dogged Obamacare for years now. In many areas, Humana is the only carrier left, so this will mean even more instability.
Also this week, the Trump administration issued its first Obamacare regulations, including restricting sign-up on the exchanges for individual health insurance plans. Sarah Cliff is the senior editor at Vox.com. She covers health policy. It's good to talk with you, Sarah.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
First of all, let's fact check what House Speaker Ryan just said in that tape there, that Humana is leaving the marketplace in areas, and because, in his words, a lot of young people aren't signing up. Is that true?
Yeah, that is basically what Humana was saying, that they are – what they said, which is kind of wonky, is they said the risk pool isn't good, which is essentially insurance speak for saying there are too many sick people, not enough healthy people. I don't think the consequences – are quite as devastating as Speaker Ryan says. We do now have 16 counties in Tennessee where Humana was the only carrier. Those counties currently have no one signed up to sell in 2018. So it's problematic. It's not the end of the world for the ACA marketplaces, but it certainly poses some challenges, especially if others kind of see this as a signal to pull out as well.
I see. Now, in all the news that's been going on, it might actually be a surprise to some people that the Trump administration did issue some regulations about Obamacare this week. So let's take a look at some of these new rules. One of them makes the sign-up window for health plans shorter from 90 days down to 45 days. Now, why would that be something that the administration wants?
So I think they want like a little more predictable of a group in the marketplace. And this is something insurance companies, you know, have generally clamored for. They want more predictability. They want to know who is signing up. I think that it is actually possible this might backfire, that only the really motivated sicker people will sign up in that 45-day window. So we don't really know how that'll play out. But the experts I've talked to, they actually think this will create a more predictable market because you have a shorter sign-up period and you will know very quickly who has signed up. But one of the risks is that you could actually have a sicker population in the marketplace.
I see. And so then that leads us to this other new rule about restricting when people can sign up outside of open enrollment. So What effect would that have?
Yeah, so one thing insurance carriers I talk to all the time have been really worried that there are these special enrollment periods, like when you get a new job or you move to a different state, that you can sign up outside of open enrollment. Insurance companies have been worried for years now that people are gaming these special enrollment periods, that they're signing when they don't move or when they don't lose a job. And they were able to do this because you only have to submit your documentation after you use the change and you get signed up for insurance. So what this change does is it says, if you want to use one of these special enrollment periods, you have to provide proof first that you qualify. And I think insurance companies, they think that this will weed out anyone who's been gaming these enrollment periods, and it'll get rid of people who might be signing up just because they got really sick, not because they actually had a change in their life status.
I see. There's one other change I want to talk with you briefly about, and that's one that could affect the amount of subsidies that people receive, qualified folks receive to even afford their health insurance?
Yeah, it's a little complex how this works, but at the end of the day, they're proposing some changes that will affect the size of the premiums in the Affordable Care Act, and that will possibly have the good effect of reducing premiums a little bit. The kind of unintended negative consequence is that the size of the subsidies are tethered to the cost of a mid-level plan on the marketplaces. So if you reduce the premiums, you also reduce the size of the subsidies. So there's a bit of a worry from consumer advocates that you could have this unintended consequence if people are getting less financial help to buy their health insurance.
I see. So we've got just under a minute to go, Sarah. Can we read anything about what effect these new regulations might have on House Republicans' move to repeal and replace Obamacare? Or are they not related at all?
It seems like they're not going to move the needle much in either way. I think these are some of the smaller changes health insurers wanted. But the experts I've talked to said it's not a big enough change to kind of convince people who are going to leave to stay or to change anyone's decision. I think, honestly, what insurance companies really want, they want more money. They want to be told if we're going to lose a lot of money, the government's going to backstop us in a way. And the Trump administration hasn't gone that far. So I don't think it moves the needle much and really will come to a really important moment in about a few months, yeah, in April or May, when insurers have to decide if they want to sell in 2018. And we'll see what they do.
Sarah Cliff, senior editor at Vox. Thanks so much, Sarah.
Thank you.
Say you've been traveling abroad and you're coming back to the United States. You're going through customs and a Border Patrol agent tells you to hand over your phone passcode or unlock the device and give it to them. What do you do? Well, there have been reports of Border Patrol agents asking people to do exactly that. So what are your rights to privacy at the border when it comes to your mobile devices? Orrin Kerr is a law professor at George Washington University, and he specializes in computer crime law and digital evidence investigation. Welcome to Here and Now.
Glad to be here.
So first of all, let me just get right to it. Is it legal for Customs and Border Patrol agents to ask a U.S. citizen to unlock their phone when they're coming back into the United States?
It's legal for them to ask. The real question is what happens if somebody says no.
Right. So let me rephrase that. Good point. Do you have to comply?
You probably don't have to comply. There are no court cases that have actually tested this, and we really don't know what the legal limits are on the government getting people to unlock their phones.
Okay, interesting. So what does case law then say on Or how close does case law come then to helping us find an answer to this question? Because there have been some cases about the government is definitely, if it has a warrant, the CBP can take your phone and unlock it, right?
And they don't even need a warrant. It's clear the government does not need a warrant to search the phone based on a constitutional law, a set of cases called the border search exception. So ordinary rule, if the government wants to search your phone, they would need a search warrant. They'd need to go to a judge and say, hey, judge, there's probable cause to believe there's evidence on this phone. They don't need that at the border because of a longstanding exception to the constitutional doctrine under the Fourth Amendment that says at the border, the government has special powers to search and seize. They basically, the government needs to know what's coming into the country to look for things that are being smuggled in or even what's leaving the country. So some courts have said the government can search a computer without any suspicion. Other courts have said the government needs what's called reasonable suspicion. It's basically the same cause that the government would need to stop somebody and question them on the street. And if they have that reasonable suspicion, it's clear the government can conduct a search, even a very invasive forensic search of the phone. That doesn't necessarily mean they can get someone's help to do it, though. It just means they can search it if they can figure out a way to search the phone.
Right. And that bar of reasonableness, it's pretty low.
Yeah, reasonable suspicion is not a very high standard, and you as the traveler won't know if the government has that suspicion. So they may have reasonable suspicion when you don't know it, and that means that you're kind of not fully aware of what the government thinks at the time they're searching a phone.
Yeah. Now, I know the government has frequently argued in these digital privacy cases that courts have already given them the right to open people's physical luggage. And so, you know, why not translate that right to the information suitcase, essentially, that is your cell phone?
Yeah, so the big counterargument is based on a Supreme Court case from 2014 called Riley versus California, in which the Supreme Court said that searching a cell phone is just different from searching a physical item. And in that case, the Supreme Court required a warrant to search a cell phone when somebody's arrested, even though the traditional law is that when somebody's arrested, the government is free to search their pockets, search through their wallet, search through books that they may have on them. And the Supreme Court said it's just computer searches are different. And the real question here is how different are computer searches in the border search context? Some courts say, well, that requires extra suspicion to search a phone. Other courts say, no, it's actually the same thing. There's just a lot of disagreement in the lower courts, and the Supreme Court has not yet taken this issue.
Okay, so let's get back to the specifics of Border Patrol agents asking for people's passcodes to unlock their phones. I mean, Has this been going on for some time, and we're just noticing it now because there's this renewed focus and interest on what's happening at America's borders?
It's actually historically been very uncommon for the Border Patrol to search phones or search computers. Many, many people cross the U.S. border all the time, every day, millions of people. And these sorts of searches are very rare. So that's an important context. Whether that's changing today with the Trump administration, we don't really know. It's really tough to go from these anecdotal reports to, you know, the real data and knowing what's actually changing.
Yeah. And I wonder what you make of the specifics of the stories we're hearing from people who have been asked by Customs and Border Patrol to unlock their phones. I mean, there was one that just happened recently at the end of last month where a U.S. citizen, a NASA scientist, returned from South America through Houston, I believe, and U.S. Customs and Border Patrol told him, quote, he was not allowed to leave until he unlocked his phone for them, and that they, in fact, did detain him. And a Border Patrol officer insisted that he had the authority to search the phone and even gave this NASA scientist a document that apparently listed a series of consequences for failing to offer the information asked by Customs and Border Patrol. I mean, I guess they can ask you anything, but it does seem as if the Border Patrol is making it seem like they have the legal right to tell you to unlock your phone.
Yeah, so there's a bunch of different issues here, and let me take the lawyer's approach and break them down. So the first issue is, can they search the phone? And the answer is probably, if they can figure it out on their own, they can search the phone. The second question is, can they detain you until you hand over your passcode? They probably have some power to detain you for a little bit, maybe for an hour or two, not forever. They can't, you know, hold you at the border and say, all right, you're living here until you hand over your passcode. And the question that's uncertain is whether you have the law requires you to answer the question. There is a law that might apply and might require you to answer the question, but it's not at all clear it applies to these situations. And even then, you'd be able to say, hey, I assert the Fifth Amendment privilege. I feel like I have a constitutional right not to answer. And that would then have to go before a judge to figure out whether that's right. So the government is asserting this power, we think, but it's not clear how widely it's being asserted. And the rules here are just really unclear.
So are you recommending that's what people do, that they should assert their Fifth Amendment right if they're asked to unlock their phones?
You know, it's hard to give people legal advice over the radio, but this isn't happening all that often, and we don't know, importantly, exactly what the government's position is. We're getting reports from individuals about conversations they had, and we're getting one or two reports here and there. What I think we really need to know is, what is the actual policy the government is following? Once we know what that policy really is, then we can start talking about what are responses different people can take.
Now, we've been focusing on the rights of U.S. citizens, which, as you've been telling us, because there's so much uncertainty, we don't fully know the answer there at the border. But I imagine there's even more uncertainty if you're not a U.S. citizen, even if you're a legal permanent resident.
If you're a U.S. citizen or a legal permanent resident, the rules are the same okay. In terms of your constitutional rights. It's an extra uncertainty if you're, say, visiting from abroad. Ordinarily, we'd say the Constitution only gives constitutional rights to people that are U.S. citizens or permanent resident aliens, except once they've landed in the United States, they may then have Fourth Amendment rights because they then have voluntary contacts with the United States. So it may be that the government has more power in that context, but it may be that the rules are the same. We really don't entirely know.
Now, I know you were slightly reluctant to give legal advice on the radio, but I can guarantee you I'm curious, and I'm sure many, many people listening to this are also, because there seem to be a lot of articles that say, you know, you should encrypt your phones, you should turn them off, turn off Touch ID, all sorts of things. I mean, are we living in an age where people who do want to protect their data privacy, like, should they be recommended to take extraordinary steps?
It's, I think, hard to say, you know, should people take the following steps? Because you'd have to ask yourself, against what threat? So the fear is that we've got a rogue government that's violating all the constitutional rules and is searching people unfairly, is targeting political dissenters. Those are the anxieties. So people might say, well, that's how I see myself, and so I will take these steps. The premise of the question is not yet clear. So right. I think it's too early to say, you know, we have to stop this. And go back to the example of the NASA scientist. It may be that actually there have been anonymous reports about this NASA scientist and what he's actually carrying on his phone. And it may be those reports are completely wrong. Maybe they're right. We don't know. But this may actually be good government law enforcement steps rather than kind of a crazy situation. We just don't know because we only get the one side of the story. So it's really hard to say from one case that this is the new world we're in and this is how you should respond.
Yeah, no, that's a very, very important point, and I'm glad you made it. But from what I hear you saying, there isn't any legal certainty or not adequate legal certainty about whether or not you're required to hand over your passcode to unlock your phone. So is a court case the only way to get that certainty?
Yeah, the way things would work out in the legal system is somebody would refuse to hand over their passcode. They might sue the government, or the government might bring an enforcement action against them. And then a court can figure out, okay, let me work through how the law applies here. And so what happens is the law gets clarified when the court starts saying, here's something that happened, here's how the law applies. We just don't have those cases yet because these policies are new and, you know, encryption on iPhones is pretty new. And so we're just starting to get these problems. And it takes the legal system a couple years for all the lawyers to get together and a lawsuit to be filed and a judge to make one decision. And then the losing party is going to appeal. And it works its way up to the Supreme Court. And then 5 or 10 years later, the Supreme Court says, okay, here's the rule. Here's the law. And so we just have a natural period of uncertainty until that happens.
Professor Kerr, if you were flying back into Reagan National from an overseas trip and you were asked to unlock your phone at the border, would you?
You know, I teach constitutional criminal procedure, so I think I'm obligated to assert my Fifth Amendment rights and see what happens.
Well, Oren Kerr is a law professor at George Washington University, and he specializes in computer crime law, amongst other things. Professor Kerr, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
This podcast and the following message are made possible by The Economist. From politics to business and finance, from science and technology to the arts, readers are brought clear analysis of the issues that lie behind each week's global news stories. The Economist's content satisfies the globally curious with a distilled view of world affairs that is intelligent, insightful, and thought-provoking. Sign up for an introductory offer at economist.com/now.
The NBA All-Star Game will be played on Sunday night in New Orleans, and that wasn't supposed to be the case. The game was originally scheduled for Charlotte, but the NBA moved it out of North Carolina after that state's controversial transgender bathroom bill. Mike Pesca is Here and Now sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast The Gist at Slate.com. Hi, Mike.
Hello.
And what about that location change? What do you think that says about the NBA that they did that?
It confirms that the NBA is the most progressive of the leagues, and they are not unwilling. Let's do away with the double negatives. They're willing to wade into social controversies. Their players certainly, but even their management. And just as an interesting aside, a member of the Cleveland Cavaliers, and this was talking about the recent contretemps around some of the members of the New England Patriots saying they're not going to visit the Trump White House. So a member of the Cleveland Cavaliers tweeted, "I'm proud to be the last NBA team to visit the White House," implying that it's not going to happen under the Trump administration. That's the NBA. That's what that league is.
And what about the game itself, the All-Star game? It's always a showcase for the best players in the NBA. Who should we be watching for this year?
Yes, I hate the All-Star game. It's not that I love defense, but it's just, you know, three quarters of up and down the court, wildly flinging the ball. That's fine. I enjoy dunk competitions and three-point shooting. I just think the construction of the rosters, I mean, is so amazing. There are so many great players in the NBA. If you look at the West starting lineup, Steph Curry, James Harden, Kevin Durant, Kawhi Leonard, and Anthony Davis, the possible, if not probable, MVP, Russell Westbrook, isn't even named a starter. I mean, that starting lineup is such a murderer's row, they might even be able to take the Golden State Warriors to six games. The East starters, though, include LeBron James and Jimmy Butler and the guy they call the Greek Freak on Milwaukee. I'm not going to try to pronounce Gian Antetokounmpo's last name. Two members of the Toronto Raptors, Kyrie Irving and DeMar DeRozan, which is odd that 40% of the starting team would be Toronto Raptors, but this reflects the fact that Raptors fans are passionate and fans get a vote in this.
All right, well...
And those guys are good. And those guys are good.
As we wait for that, there is one more thing I have to ask you about, which involves the New York Knicks and a former player, Charles Oakley, who was arrested at a recent game because he was heckling the team's owner. What is all this about?
Well, he was okay. I'm not even sure if he was heckling the team owner. There are various accounts, but Charles Oakley, who was a member of a beloved Knick who wasn't, he was actually an all-star at one point, but he was just the kind of guy who would get rebounds and throw elbows and reflected the Knicks fans' self-perception as tough. And the Knicks are so terrible, and their owner, James Dolan, is so hated. And Oakley, paying his way into the world's most famous arena, was confronted by security. We're not sure why. Maybe just because he sat near James Dolan in a seat he paid for. It would seem that Oakley put his hands on security first. Things got terrible from there. The latest is that Adam Silver, the NBA commissioner, got Oakley and Dolan in a room. They got Michael Jordan on the call. He tried to make peace. Dolan says he wants to extend an olive branch. Oakley says he's not ready for that. And this is a much more entertaining sideshow than what the Knicks are putting on the floor.
Okay. Mike Pesca here and now, sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, thanks as always.
You're welcome.
Native American rapper Frank Juan is out with a new song. It's about justice, and he says he wants every American citizen who hears it to pressure our government to follow its own laws and honor its treaties. Last year, Juan did a benefit show to support the Standing Rock protesters. He's also written songs about oppression and alcoholism. We spoke with him last April, and I asked him what drew him to the kind of music he makes.
Yeah, I was born and raised out on the Rosewood Reservation, located in South Central South Dakota. And, you know, whenever I was growing up, whenever I was a kid, hip-hop just resonated with a lot of Native youth from my generation, especially growing up on reservations, because we could relate to the stories being told in the music. And I started writing poetry when I was in middle school. I started playing piano when I was 9. So all that kind of just came out into what I do today as a music artist, producer, and performer.
Well, give me an example. What kind of a song were you listening to that resonated with you?
Definitely Nas. When I heard his song One Mic, I was in 7th grade, and I was digging hip hop, and it just totally spoke to me, the way Nas was telling the story of his community in a very raw way, but also speaking to his community and saying that, you know, we can create change and we can help each other. That was a very powerful message for me. And when I heard that, I said, I want to do that.
Left me cause they thought I was finished. Should've knew she wasn't true. She came to me when a man caught a sentence. Diamonds are blinded. I never make the same mistakes. Moving with a change of pace, lighter load. See, now the king is straight. Swelling my melon cause none of these real hurt equal. Telling police how can a kingpin squeal. This is crazy. I'm on the right track. I'm finally found. You need some soul searching. The time is now.
All I need is one mic. One mic.
But some people may be surprised to hear that you hear a connection between what is broadly the inner city African-American experience in this country and the on-the-reservation Native American experience in this country.
Yes, well, you know, there definitely are differences. I would say that, you know, black folks are coming up out of a history of slavery that their ancestors had to endure. And my ancestors and myself, we're coming up out of a history of genocide. So, you know, we're both being oppressed by this system that was imposed on us. So there's definitely similarities in coming up in those type of communities, especially in a poor community of color. So I actually learned that whenever I moved to Chicago and I started, you know, doing workshops or going into schools that were in inner city Chicago. And I saw the parallels there, and I didn't even know they really existed. And then it started to make sense why I gravitated towards those music and those stories. So like I said, there's differences, but there's also parallels.
Well, let's listen to a song that you've done here. This is off of your earlier EP. It's called White War.
I bet their hearts drop when they hear these drums and hear our songs now. Tired of being oppressed, we standing strong now. Can't whitewash me in this white war. You can't speak about people you don't fight for. When they hear these drums and hear our songs now. Tired of being oppressed, we standing strong now. Can't whitewash me in this white war. You can't speak about people you don't fight for.
You can't whitewash me in this white war. What are you singing about there?
I'm talking about the way history is taught in the United States. Whenever I came to Chicago to go to school, I actually met met a person my first week here that was living in my dorm who thought Native Americans are extinct. She thought we were gone and dead, and it really shook me. And I started looking at the way, you know, history is taught in this country, and a lot of history books don't mention us past the 1800s. So I was talking about that sort of whitewashing of history, how history was told by the victors, and how, you know, our side of the story is never told, but it's just as much American history as anything else.
Who's your audience? Are you speaking to other Native Americans, or are you trying to speak to other people who are not living on reservations and never did?
I'm speaking to both, honestly, but I would say my target audience is Native youth, because I know what they went through. You know, we grew up in similar circumstances, so I think it's really important that young Native youth see positive Native role models doing what they love and succeeding and getting our stories out there to the world.
Let's listen to another one of your songs. This is called Runaway.
Wake up with the blues, blue skies, take a cruise. This city ain't my home, you left me here alone. Dark skies seem so surreal, I can't tell her how I feel. I can't tell you how I feel. I just need to run away. I've been running since the winter time. My mother called the sun today.
If you were to ask me to list the Native American rappers that I know, at this point, you would be the only one. Are there others that have been able to inspire you?
Yes, definitely. There's many others. There's others that have come before me, and there's many doing it now. But I would say one of the biggest influences on me, he was more of a poet, but he was doing something similar to what I try to do, is John Trudell. He actually recently passed away, but he's a Native American activist and poet and actor, and he's been a big influence on me. But, you know, there's Native musicians across all genres out there doing it, but we're just finally getting platforms and starting to get looks from people outside of Indian country.
What's that song Runaway about?
That song is a very personal song. This album, Tokia, is a very personal album. It's actually, a lot of it is telling the story of how I'm trying to deal and heal from the historical trauma that has been dealt to me through my ancestors and through being a survivor of genocide, and that how that resulted in me struggling with depression since the time I was a child. So that song, Runaway, is about this bad emotional habit I had to run away from my problems, and also just the loneliness of coming to a large city and being away from my family and my home, and how I felt so alone in a city amongst millions because no one understood me as an indigenous person.
Do you think that you'll ever go back to the reservation?
Oh, yeah. I just came back from there. I was there 2 days ago. I went and did a show at a middle school on our reservation, and I did a workshop with some kids and helped them write a song. So I try to go home as much as I can.
But will you ever go back and move back?
Yes, most definitely. But right now, I want to travel the world. I recently started getting some international gigs, and the nearest airport from my home res is 3 hours away, so it would really be hard to be a traveling artist, and I fly every week, so Chicago is a good hub for me right now because an airport's really close.
Hmm. I know that you've also written about the Keystone XL pipeline. What inspired you there?
Well, I wrote a song about the Keystone XL pipeline about 4 or 5 years ago. They were actually trying to build the pipeline through a portion of our reservation back home. So I thought, you know, what way can I contribute to help my home community try to protect our water? So I just decided to use my gift and write a song for it. And it led to some great opportunities. I actually got to share the stage with Willie Nelson and Neil Young at a concert to raise awareness and funds for that effort.
My ancestors studied numbers and astrology. Lakota philosophy, keep them haters off of me. Keystone XL, you smell like an atrocity. To my home and my ancestors, I'm loyal. Build that pipeline and I'm burning down your oil.
So with all of these ideas and all of your views on these issues that are so important to you and to your community, why become a rapper instead of a politician and try to fix it?
Because I'm not passionate about politics. You know, I'm passionate about music. At the end of the day, I'm going to be making music until the day I die. I just love to do it. It makes me feel happy. It's like an itch that I have to scratch. So I just think it's really beautiful that I found a way to use what I love to help heal people and to help heal myself and to tell my story to the world, you know, stories that have been kind of suppressed and silenced for many years. So I just do it because I love to make music.
As you mentioned, you hold workshops for young people. What have they told you about what the things that you do mean to them?
You know, it's a... The reaction that I get from Native youth is worth more to me than money. Almost every time I do a show in an indigenous community, a young Native person comes up to me and tells me that my music or my performance has changed their life. And I remember when I was growing up, I never seen a young Native person from a reservation, you know, on a mainstream platform talking about real issues and just being honest about who we are and where we come from and doing what they love and being successful. So I think, you know, I'm part of a generation that's starting to be that for these coming generations of indigenous youth.
What do you think that Americans don't know about the Native American experience that they should?
I would say genocide did happen in this country, and our people did survive genocide. They tried to wipe us out many times, and that influences our reality, whether we want it to or not. And I think that, you know, if people understood the indigenous reality and experience a lot more, we would be able to understand the United States of America a lot more and work out our issues a little more easily.
Our conversation with Native American rapper Frank Juan from last spring. And we're listening now to Frank Juan's The Feel Good Song featuring Cody DeNoyer and Sam Sochi Sampson. This is Here and Now.
Human Rights Watch says that Syrian government forces used chlorine gas to purge rebel-held areas of Aleppo at the end of last year, killing at least 9 civilians and injuring hundreds more. For more, we're joined via Skype by Ula Solvang. He's deputy director of the Emergencies Division for Human Rights Watch. And Ula, when did these attacks allegedly take place, and what evidence do you have?
So the latest attacks that we documented was during the final weeks of the battle for Aleppo, so in November and December of last year. And what we found was that Syrian government helicopters had been dropping chlorine bombs on populated areas in Aleppo in the context of that offensive when ground forces were trying to take back control over Aleppo. And the most striking aspect of these attacks, we documented 8 attacks, but there were several munitions dropped in each attack. The most striking aspect of it was that it was clear that these attacks were clearly coordinated with the overall military strategy. So we saw that ground forces were trying to move in from the east, and chlorine attacks would hit the districts in the east. As the front line moved, the location of the chlorine attacks also moved, so it was always one step ahead of advancing ground troops. And to us, this is a very strong indication that senior military commanders in charge of the Aleppo offensive at least knew about the use of these chlorine bombs.
And this is based on what? Interviews with some survivors?
So we interviewed 22 people who had firsthand experience with these attacks. So these were first responders. They were medical personnel who treated victims. They were journalists or activists who arrived at the scene shortly after the attacks. Or they were just people from the neighborhoods where these attacks took place. In addition to that, we've reviewed videos and we have reviewed photographs. We've corroborated that and compared it with social media posts. And so the evidence is really strong.
So what do the videos and the photographs show? Do they show the helicopters? Do they show the remnants of the ordnance that were dropped? What do you see in this imagery?
Exactly. So in some of these cases, we have footage of the helicopters that dropped these bombs. We have obtained photographs or video footage of the remnants of these gas cylinders in 7 different places. So the gas cylinders, together with both eyewitness testimony and video footage of a yellow-green gas, witnesses telling us that it smelled chlorine at the sites, and the symptoms that people described, all of these point in one direction, and that is towards the use of chlorine gas.
I see. Now, this isn't the first time that the Syrian government is said to have used chemical weapons in the current conflict.
That's correct. Human Rights Watch has documented the use of chlorine gas by Syrian government forces going back as far as April 2014. And even as an investigation appointed by the UN Security Council came back in October last year, having concluded that Syrian government forces used chlorine in at least three cases. What we haven't seen yet is the Security Council acting on that information. And that's what we're calling for. We feel that the next logical step now is for the Security Council to impose sanctions on those who are responsible for using chemicals as weapon in violation of international law in Syria.
Final question. Of course, back in 2012, then-President Barack Obama very famously said that the use of chemical weapons would be a, quote, red line in the Syrian conflict that, if crossed, could warrant U.S. military action. His administration was subsequently criticized when the Syrian government did cross that line and the United States did not intervene militarily. But what did happen was that Syrian President Bashar Assad did admit that he had chemical weapons and supposedly destroyed much of his chemical weapons stock. But if this latest attack did happen, what does that say about how many chemical weapons the regime still has?
Right. So there is a difference here between chemical weapons and using chemicals as weapon. And what the Syrian government was forced to do by the Security Council, by the US and by Russia, was to give up its chemical weapons programs. But chlorine, for example, has many legitimate civilian uses. You use it for water purification, you use it for cleaning, for example. And so you can't ban an entire country from having chlorine.
But on the other hand, Syria did join the Chemical Weapons Convention, right?
Exactly, they did. So using chlorine as a weapon in the way that we've seen Syrian government forces doing it is a clear violation of the Chemical Weapons Convention. And our concern is that Syria's continued use of chemicals will significantly undermine it and lower the threshold for other countries to do so unless the Security Council takes strong action.
Well, Ulla Solvang is Deputy Director of the Emergencies Division for Human Rights Watch. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty along with Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.